Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Today's program is our answer to those who argue that the global flood, specifically Dr. Walt Brown's Fountains of the Great Deep model of creation and the flood, that Dr. Brown's model would produce too much heat. It would boil the oceans, cook the atmosphere, and melt the crust if, in fact, it had actually happened. You know, just thinking about it, it's getting hot in here already. So today, we'll see if we can answer these critics. We provide evidence for atheists at our website, rsr.org/evidence, and a second list right there of evidence for Christians, powerful evidence in both lists to show that the global flood indeed happened. That's at rsr.org/evidence. Now, among creation scientists, the main alternative to Walt Brown's model is a plate tectonics model for the global flood. It's called catastrophic plate tectonics. And these CPT, advanced degreed scientists, they admit that the radioactive decay apparent in Earth's crust creates their own heat problem from what they call accelerated radioactive decay. Accelerated, that is, to happen in just a year or so instead of over billions of years. And they admit, the CPT scientists, they admit that the crust would melt by accelerated radioactive decay. And they also admit that they don't have a scientific answer. So it's interesting that they will so strongly criticize Walt Brown's model and say he has a heat problem. It reminds me of the pot calling the kettle black, but in this instance, we'll see whether or not, in contrast, whether or not the hydroplate theory does have scientific answers to the heat critics. But regarding where did the water come from for the flood, I think all those creation scientists would agree with this. If the water for the global flood came from below the Earth's crust, then that means that their CPT model is wrong, and Dr. Walt Brown's Fountains of the Great Deep hydroplate theory is correct. Where did the water come from? Walt's model describes the water for the global flood coming up from under the Earth's crust through a globe-encircling crack, which was located where today there stands the aftermath, the 40,000-mile-long mid-oceanic ridge, which then rose up and wraps around the globe like a seam on a baseball. Now, that water came up from 60 miles deep with such energy that a lot of the rock and debris that broke off the crust, it reached escape velocity and was ejected into space, beating up the moon. You know, why is the near side beat up so much worse than the far side, and filling the solar system with debris and dangerous projectiles, including meteoroids like errant bullets? So we are not surprised by many recent astronomy headlines, including what NASA considers to be Earth's oldest rock. And it was found where? It was found on the moon. An Apollo mission collected it a half century ago, but only just now in 2019, they announced that it came from the Earth. Wow. And then the European Space Agency, they landed a craft on a comet, Comet 67P, and they were shocked to see that it was made up of rounded boulders, what seems like a million of them, up to 10 feet in diameter, making the comet a flying rock pile. So we have a saying here on Real Science Radio that all scientists work for Walt Brown. when these headlines hit, like with so many others, we had listeners across the country, even around the world, emailing us things like, hey, Europe's space program works for Walt Brown. And NASA scientists work for Walt Brown. Yes, of course they do. Because all scientists work for Dr. Brown, whether they realize it or not, because he is the author of the Fountains of the Great Deep model of the creation and the global flood, known as the hydroplate theory. So then here's the problem. If super hot water beneath the crust erupted in the fountains and ejected all that debris into space, wouldn't that overheat the atmosphere and the oceans and the crust of the Earth? To discuss that, I've asked a hydroplate theory expert to join us, like Walt Brown, who received his PhD from MIT's Heat Transfer Division in their engineering department and who worked in their heat transfer lab. Like Dr. Brown, Brian Nickel is also a mechanical engineer. He's worked for 18 years in the missile division of a U.S. aerospace firm. So, Brian, who are the critics that we're going to respond to regarding their arguments about heat?
Well, we're going to address some well-known anti-creationists like Glenn Kubin and Tony Reed, right, and also some well-known creation scientists such as astronomer Danny Faulkner and geophysicist John Baumgartner.
Yes, and Brian, I have spoken in person, met in person with both of those latter men, the creationists. In fact, Danny Faulkner is a friend of Real Science Radio. He's, of course, with Ken Ham's Answers in Genesis. And Dr. Baumgartner was from Los Alamos National Laboratory, and then he went to Henry Morris's Institute for Creation Research.
Yes, it's difficult to keep up with so many critiques from so many sources.
Yeah.
And it becomes a choice of, do you want to do more research or work on a new video for hydroplate theory, or do I want to rehash information that I've already considered with a particular critique?
Right.
So it can chew up a lot of time. So I'm very thankful to you, Bob, and your RSR research team for compiling the sources of all these critiques and putting them into a list. This greatly aided me in reviewing these things efficiently and determining who said what, so as to examine the types of arguments out there and to determine where the disagreements lie.
Yeah, well, there are three main areas of criticism, and they regard the atmosphere, the oceans, and the crust. So heat transfer to the atmosphere, heat transfer into the oceans, and heating of the crust, some by friction, by radioactivity, and so on. We'll get into the particular arguments. And the criticism, they fall into these three areas: the atmosphere, the oceans, and the crust. Heat transfer from the hydroplate theory to the atmosphere, heat transfer into the oceans, and then the heating of the crust, some by friction, mostly by radioactivity. So what we're going to do is look at these criticisms from these atheists and creationists. I'd like us to start, Brian, with Glenn Kubin. He's an anti-creationist at the website paleo.cc, and his arguments, let's list them. He says the release of pressurized water in the eruption of the fountains of the Great Deep would deposit tremendous energy, and so heat, from that eruption of water on the surface of the Earth. And he says the temperature of the floodwaters, they come from below the crust, and those subterranean waters being what's called supercritical, that is, supercritical water, as Walt Brown admits, they were at least 1,300 degrees Fahrenheit and hotter. So that's the beginning of Glenn Kubin's argument.
Right. And Kubin also mentions that hydroplate theory suggests that at least half of today's ocean waters were once below the crust. So with all that hot supercritical water coming up to the surface, he claims that it would have mixed with the surface waters and would have boiled the oceans.
Yeah. And he also talks about the friction from the continent sliding. This is called the compression event in Walt Brown's hydroplate theory. When the continents slid and the mountains rose up in a day, that's as the continents were sliding away from the rising mid-oceanic ridges, and they crashed. He points out that's a lot of friction, and that's going to add tremendous heat again to the surface of the Earth.
Then there's the massive volcanic activity and the release of magma.
Yeah, and that's true, right? That did happen during the flood.
Right, so he includes that as another heat problem.
In fact, Fred Williams and I, last summer, we did a series on the eruption in Hawaii and volcanic eruptions generally, and what's called the hotspot model of islands forming. And we listed the incredible magma flows that occurred during the flood, and they were massive, so that's a pretty good point. And Glenn Kubin also talks about the hot water coming up from below the crust and so much of it falling back down on the earth as rain. That happened for 40 days. So he's arguing, hey, that's going to add heat too to the surface of the earth.
Right. And then he also adds that the accelerated nuclear decay that Walt talks about would also add heat to levels that he believes would be lethal levels of heat and radiation.
Okay. So that's a summary of Glenn Kubin. Then we can look at Tony Reed. He has a YouTube channel called Creationism Taught Me Real Science. Creationism Taught Me Real Science, and he's an anti-creationist, and he has about 7,000 subscribers. So he's sort of popular, and his heat criticisms of Walt Brown's theory that the supercritical water that came up from below the crust, that it should have transferred its heat to the atmosphere and scald the planet, saying that although air doesn't conduct heat well, steam conducts heat very well. So that's one of his arguments. And then he says that wind is usually due to a temperature differential of only a few degrees, yet the hydroplate theory has 1,000 degree water, and that differential would easily spread the heat throughout the atmosphere.
Yeah, and then Reed also claims that the water and crustal debris ejected to the upper atmosphere wouldn't have been able to lose its heat because conduction and convection was not available to it, and then claims that radiation is the weakest form of heat transfer.
Yeah, that seems to be his argument there. So if the water and debris can only radiate their heat, then it's going to fall back down to the earth very hot. So that's an interesting argument he's making. You know, and Brian, when I look at Tony Reed's YouTube channel and compare it to yours and mine, he has more subscribers, more views than we do. And so there are these anti-creationists who are going to hear his argument about no conduction, no convection up near the edges of space, and they're going to think it must be a good argument. They only have radiation as a way to lose the heat of the water that falls back down. And then also he makes an argument after the first 40 days, and some of the other critics make the same argument, after the first 40 days when the fountains of the great deep are no longer launching debris into space and it's no longer raining, but the waters continue to rise for another 110 days. That means that all that superheated water from below the crust, this is Tony's argument, is going directly into the oceans. None of it is going into space any longer, and it's not even going up into the atmosphere. It's just pumping all that heat right into the oceans. So those are the arguments from Tony Reed.
Yeah, well, it sure can sound very convincing.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, Danny Faulkner, who is an astronomer with Answers in Genesis, he published a back-of-the-envelope calculation where he concluded that if even a tiny fraction of the energy that Walt calculates in the hydroplate theory mixed with the surface, that it would be catastrophic as far as the heating amount, and that a large amount of kinetic energy would have transferred from the jets to the atmosphere. That's what Danny alleges.
And then he also says, and again, we're I'd say good friends with Danny Faulkner. When I see him, we enjoy each other's company. He's hysterical with his jokes. I just enjoy Danny Faulkner. But he also argues that when water is moving at the speeds that Walt Brown indicates, right, escape velocity is a minimum of 7 miles per second. And to get the retrograde comets and all, you need debris launching at 32 miles per second. So the water's moving fast. That would produce tremendous turbulence. And that turbulence, Danny says, would slow down at least a portion of the water jet and transfer kinetic energy to the atmosphere. And then related to that, he says the leading edge or the top of the jet of water, it transfers momentum to the atmosphere, and that would slow the leading edge. And material behind that leading edge would then do the same thing. It's a cascading effect, he says, slowing the water below it, and that this would cause the leading edge of the jet to spread horizontally. So, Brian, you use a rocket exhaust example that I think will be very helpful when we address this.
Yes, I found it to be something that I think people can visualize, and I think it will explain what Danny is visualizing, but also show how it actually moves material out away from the part of the atmosphere that contains life and would not have been an issue for hydroplate theory.
Mm. So then finally, Danny argues that the atmosphere is essentially stagnant and the fountain jets are moving incredibly quickly. And so then he calls on Bernoulli's equation, which will show a very large pressure difference that will drive air into the jet and will thermalize the kinetic energy. So that's his argument, right? The jets are going up, low pressure. The atmosphere is going to rush into those jets, and you're going to get a lot of heat that way also.
That's what Danny puts in his article. I think we can explain some things that will show that this also is not as big of an issue as one might think when they first read Danny's article.
And Brian, I wonder if the audience, people who've listened, long listened to RSR, if they could realize already how restrained you and I are being, because normally we present something we think is wrong and we jump all over it, right? But we want to first, on this program, we want to first lay out the arguments of the critics and then begin to respond to them. So the final critic then is John Baumgartner. He's the Los Alamos creation scientist who went on to work for Henry Morris. And he criticizes the hydroplate theory's origin of radioactivity chapter. And Dr. Baumgartner writes about the extreme heat released from radioactive fission of super heavy elements. So that's one of his arguments. And then he takes Dr. Brown's own energy estimate of, you know, so many joules of kinetic energy on the order of 10 to the 30th joules of energy carried by what's called fast neutrons. And he points out that that energy is enough to vaporize the entire granite crust hundreds of times over. So he takes Dr. Walt Brown's estimate of energy, and this is the energy involved in producing the deuterium, which is the heavy hydrogen in today's oceans. And he says that alone would vaporize the entire granite crust hundreds of times over. And he provides some calculations to make that point.
Yeah, and then John also envisions that this waste heat from fission, which fission is when an atom breaks apart, this waste heat from the fission of super heavy elements surely must be dwarfed by the much larger amount of waste heat by a factor of 10 released in the fusion process, which is when atoms are smashed together to create new larger atoms. Mm-hmm. And that's what Dr. Brown invokes for the creation of super heavy elements.
Yeah, like uranium and thorium and so on. So Dr. Baumgartner is saying all that heat that was going to melt the crust hundreds of times over, that's dwarfed by a factor of 10 all the heat that's going to come from fusion of these radioactive elements that are really dangerous in the crust of the Earth. And then John Baumgartner, and here I'll quote him verbatim, he writes that, note that Dr. Brown does not mention even once the gigantic problem of the waste heat that is implied by his processes. Why does Brown not mention this waste heat issue? One obvious reason is that there is no conceivable solution for it. And Brian, this is going to be so interesting when we get to this part of where did these dangerous radioactive elements come from in the crust of the Earth, uranium and thorium and so on. Well, they came from fusion. And in Walt Brown's chapter on the origin of radioactivity, he points out the experimental evidence that shows that fusion is adiabatic, that is, it doesn't produce heat. So that is part of the response. But also, it just strikes me how Dr. Baumgartner, in his own defense of catastrophic plate tectonics, he appeals to miracles happening three times in the model unfolding. And then to deal with all the heat in their model, they actually argue, him and the other scientists who support his model, they say that God did a miracle and removed the heat. So
right.
I really don't understand how it is that they could make this argument against Walt's theory. If Walt did not have an answer to the heat problem, well, neither do they. And Walt could just say, well, God did a miracle. But to his credit, Walt doesn't appeal to miracles of convenience. He doesn't do that.
I believe earlier you were referring to the pot calling the kettle black.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's true. So a few more criticisms from John Baumgartner, then we're done with this overview. He writes that scientific rigor is not a paramount issue for Walt Brown. That's obviously an ad hominem critique. And then to close out John Baumgartner's arguments, he says that the supercritical water in the chamber below the crust, that it wouldn't even remain supercritical, as Dr. Walt Brown says, but that it would turn into a plasma. That's interesting. And he says, with that much energy, on the order of 10 to the 30 joules of thermal energy, if that's all dumped into that water below the crust, then it'd be so energetic, it would blow the crust right off the Earth. So that's Dr. Baumgartner's arguments. And Brian, what I would love us to do before we answer in detail any of these, if we could give an overview of the hydroplate theory answers to the heat problem objections, so our listeners will know where we're headed, right? We just listed all these criticisms in a summary fashion. Now, if we list about a dozen factors that help evaluate the heat consequences of Walt's theory, I think that'll be really cool.
Yeah, I think that'd be a good thing to do. So gas cools rapidly as it expands, and that's something that isn't maybe taught in grade school or anything like that, in high school and things like that. But as you get into higher learning and especially in mechanical engineering fields of heat transfer and thermodynamics, you learn about phenomena like the Joule-Thomson effect, and that's Joule, who's behind the name Joule units of energy. And
right.
Also, if students are familiar with Lord Kelvin, that's Thomson and the Joule-Thomson effect. And their research showed that expansion of a gas through a nozzle, which is also called throttling, will actually cause the gas as it runs through the nozzle to cool greatly in some conditions.
Yes.
And certainly in the conditions that hydroplate theory is talking about, the effect would be a cooling effect.
Yeah. And in fact, you've pointed me to a YouTube video. We'll play a little bit of audio. This channel has 4 million views, and it's a science teacher in front of a class showing what happens when a hot gas expands. There's also the issue of directed energy we'll be talking about, and you've provided another really neat bit of experimental evidence from a Mars rocket test video and some nearby bushes, and then another photo of another rocket test firing. And Brian, they show what happens with directed energy as compared to, say, if you just have a bomb exploding.
That's right. All of these critiques and analyses, anytime you start an analysis, you have to set your problem up correctly. And if you don't, you're going to come to some wrong conclusions.
Mm-hmm. And so of our dozen or so factors that you have to consider to understand heat transfer with the global flood theory, then there's also something called the boundary conditions, right? That's important. A lot of these assumptions assume you have full mixing. Some of them actually say, and the temperature, you know, fully averages out or full mixing, and you typically don't have anything like full mixing. So we're going to have to talk about boundary conditions.
Boundary conditions are very important to understand and set up in your problem when you're trying to solve these types of issues. And so that really plays a key role in determining what equations to use and to ensure that you're understanding the problem correctly.
So if you have a column of water shooting up through the Earth's atmosphere, it's the outside boundary of that column that's going to interact with the atmosphere, not the 99.999% inside the column.
It's that boundary is the only thing that can interact with the atmosphere.
Right,
and
right.
Then you also have to realize what's happening at that boundary. That becomes very important to understanding this issue. Mm.
Then there's also understanding the role that supercritical water played in the flood. Dr. Brown has been the pioneer in the effort among creation scientists to recognize the significance of supercritical water in the global flood. And it's interesting to see that the scientists with AIG and ICR, those guys, they're coming along and saying, hey, supercritical water is a really important factor. And to understand how supercritical water itself behaves, that's all so important.
Another very important thing to consider is the heat sink of outer space, which is nearly infinite.
So what did you just say, the heat sink?
Right. In study of heat transfer, we refer to, it could be a plate, we could refer to things as a heat sink, somewhere where heat is travels to. And so a lot of times when you're designing, say, a circuit card, well, when that circuit card is running and doing all those calculations, it gets hot and you need to put that heat somewhere. Otherwise, it's going to burn up your card. So engineers design heat sinks. Some of them could be just be a large mass of, say, something really conductive like aluminum or copper to sink that heat out of the card. And in space, it also would act like a heat sink.
Awesome.
And that's where a lot of the heat was dumped during the fountains of the Great Deep, according to hydroplate theory.
And then also air itself, the atmosphere. Air is a great insulator. When we think about like Thinsulate in mountaineering equipment, in mountaineering clothing, or even in our homes, the insulation we put in our homes, it's actually millions of tiny air pockets. So air itself is a great insulator. That's another
very important to realize and to consider. And that's one thing I have not seen are those types of considerations in some of these critiques.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is something called the Z-pinch, which is basically, it's been witnessed in lightning strikes that heavier nuclei are created when lightning from the clouds to the ground causes basically the oxygen and nitrogen in the air to slam together and produce heavy elements. A lab in the Ukraine has discovered that this process, the Z-pinch process, is a nearly adiabatic process. Mm. And that means that it does not exchange tremendous amounts of heat with its surroundings.
So that, in other words, when these heavy elements are being made in the Earth's crust during the flood, these dangerous elements, that Z-pinch, it's making uranium, but it's not adding a lot of heat to the crust because it's a nearly adiabatic process. In fact, it's even called cold repacking by the world's leading experts. And it does seem, Brian, that a number of the critics of the hydroplate theory, they misunderstand the Z-pinch and the origin of Earth's radioactivity with all this dangerous uranium, barium, thorium, and so on. It's all dangerous elements now in the crust. It could not have been there originally in God's perfect creation. And I think a lot of the critics are unaware of cold repacking from Z-pinch.
Well, that's an important thing to be considering. Again, the devil is in the details when you're doing a critique and doing a calculation on a particular problem.
Mm-hmm.
The other factor is time. The heat was not all released simultaneously. And I think a lot of these critiques are sort of assuming that all this heat just mixed perfectly with, say, the atmosphere or the oceans all at one time. And that's just not the case.
Mm-hmm.
Another response I would have is some of these estimates. They are very tailored a lot of times to the critiquer's viewpoint.
Mm.
Sometimes they stop just short of defeating their own argument, where they will say, oh, well, I'm going to be generous and I'm going to only take, you know, X percent of Walt's originally calculated energy. And then they use that in their calculation. And then lo and behold, they discover that it fries everything. Well,
right.
That combined with the many assumptions that they're making and some of the details that they're ignoring can lead you again to some very wrong answers.
Well, Brian, I remember maybe 3 months ago when we were laying out how we were going to approach this show, I asked you, could you check Danny's calculation here, Danny Faulkner, at one point? And you did. And what interested me is that Danny took his very generous estimate to 6 digits. But if he would have gone to 7 digits, it turns out that his calculation would have defended Walt's model, not undermined it.
Right. So that was one thing that, you know, I saw that and I wondered, well, it was interesting that the estimate was reasonable at one point, and then 1 digit over, that would have been unreasonable. I wonder what empirical thought process went into behind determining at what point do you stop.
Yeah.
It seemed like he stopped right at what was convenient.
Right. And then we only have 2 last factors that go into answering the heat criticisms. And the one is that falling cold water and ice, if you think about the water, carbon dioxide, and so on, that was launched into the upper atmosphere, as it's falling back from the edge of space back to the surface of the Earth, that will have a significant cooling effect.
That's right. And it would have been atomized small particles that were falling back. And so we'll get into it, but that'll play a big role in how much those particles could radiate.
Yeah, and in fact, after the flood, you end up with an ice age. So if God did a miracle to remove the heat, then somebody could argue, well, he removed too much heat because look how cold the Earth got. But in fact, there was something about the flood that led the globe into an ice age. So we'll talk about that. And then lastly, there's the specific heat of water. It's called the specific heat, like a watched pot never boils. It's also called heat capacity. And water's heat capacity is higher than any other common substance. That's why the oceans play this vital role in Earth's climate regulation, in our body's temperature regulation, and so on. So the specific heat of water, that's another factor. So, Brian, we've listed the heat criticisms and then an overview of the factors needed to evaluate the heat implications of the fountains of the great deep. If we could do a sequel and look at specifically how Walt Brown's hydroplate theory would affect the atmosphere and the temperature of the atmosphere, I'd love to go there next.
Yes, I look forward to it.
So what an honor this has been to have Brian Nickel on another Real Science Radio program and to have him coming back. This is going to be a neat mini series on answering the hydroplate theory's heat problems. And this then becomes part of our greater series called RSR Answers the Hydroplate Theory Objections. You could find that entire series online at rsr.org/answers. That's it. As easy as could be, rsr.org/answers, answering the hydroplate theory objections. And then also, if you'd like to support this effort, please consider going to our store. It's just rsr.org. Click on the store where you could browse our fabulous science resources. You could even make a donation one time or monthly, or subscribe to our monthly Bible studies, verse by verse through the Bible, our topical videos. There's so much there. I think you'll love it, and you'll help us stay on the air and reach more people. So this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.